I'm Dr. Bob Gill. I'm a full-time NHS GP. I'm also a training GP, so I train other GPs. My first inkling that there's a problem with COVID, I suppose, came about when we saw the BBC giving coverage, which I perceived as being negative for the government, which was to have a daily announcement of the deaths that were occurring, supposedly attributed to COVID, which struck me as very odd, given the BBC, I recognise, is really a state mouthpiece. So that sat very peculiar with me. But also very early on in the crisis, general practice was effectively told to shut down. And not to see patients face to face. And this went against every rational instinct, which was, the last thing you do is stand down the medical workforce during a health crisis. So there were
Well,
quite a few.
hang on, Bob. Sorry, but the obvious thinking there is, what if a patient has got COVID, it's passed it on to the doctor, and then another patient comes to visit the doctor, another, and it's just a way of surely about spreading a very contagious illness.
If people are ill, where are they supposed to go? The advice they were given is don't access your GP and stay at home to protect the NHS. Well, hang on, I thought the NHS was there to protect patients, and don't disturb anybody until you think you're about to die. Well, this is not any sane, rational medical advice. In terms of seeing patients which are potentially infective, well, you take mitigation, don't you? You try and make sure you have an empty waiting room, well ventilated, and you take precautions. You don't stop seeing them.
No. What about this thing you're talking about with the BBC announcing deaths? You said that they were alleged deaths from COVID. I mean, surely these people were people who died and had tested positive.
Well, so, because my interest was turned up, I started listening to other sources of information. And quite early on, I came across interviews by the inventor of PCR technology. And what he actually said himself was this was never devised as a diagnostic tool. So quite early, I was introduced to the idea of a very high false positive rate. Using that sort of testing for a virus. And then there was also this issue about the amplification used for the test, which made the false positive rate much, much higher. So these tests that we were all relying upon were extremely dodgy and never designed to be diagnostic.
No, fascinating. Well, of course, anyone who's actually got a thinking mind, and I imagine that, I mean, there must be many doctors that do worry about these things, but they don't necessarily want to rock the boat, Bob.
Well, I think there's a small group, I'd put it under less than 10% in my experience, who are critical thinkers. Unfortunately, the way the NHS and medicine works now is we have been conditioned into accepting top-down diktat without too much scrutiny because we're relatively overwhelmed with work and we trust the authorities that are telling us to practice in a certain way. So we have been conditioned to follow orders.
Yeah, maybe. Anyway, look, you are also, I know, a great advocate for the National Health Service in its originally envisioned form. And I wonder if you can explain how, I mean, we know that the waiting lists were creeping up after the Conservatives took over from Labour. We had the top-down reorganisation of the NHS, which they promised not to do by the coalition government with the Lib Dems and the Tories. Can you just give us an idea of what state the NHS was in 2020 and how COVID affected things?
Yeah, so we'd had a decade of austerity. We've had real terms, budget relative cuts. If you look at the historical rises that the NHS received in finances, you know, the decade that preceded, the average rise for the NHS was 1%. Historically, it had been 4%. So we had a real terms shrinkage in funding whilst the population was increasing. So financially, the NHS was in a bad state. The previous reforms had also enabled the significant contraction of bed capacity. So the NHS had double the capacity it has now back in the 1980s. So you've shrunk the size of the NHS, and they also set about alienating the staff by effectively wage suppression and wage theft following the financial crash. So you have a recruitment problem, a retention problem, a lack of beds, and an NHS that is severely underfunded. So the recipe for a service in that situation to be able to perform in a, you know, timely and effective manner was very low. And not only that, the reforms of 2012 set about breaking up, privatizing, and making redundant the public health expertise that we would have relied upon in a health emergency.
Now, I know you've embarked on a bit of a campaign, really, as a GP, to keep the NHS, actually to anchor it to some of the original ideas. What was the original idea, and where are we now? We've obviously drifted away a bit.
So the original idea was to make it as efficient as possible, to remove competition and to remove the burden of the administrative burden and cost of insurance, and try and get some standardization and high quality. And the best way to achieve cost effectiveness is to do it through general taxation, make it universally available so you don't have conditions attached to accessing care. You make it very streamlined, so you have a very lightweight bureaucracy, which was around 5% before Thatcher came into office. So the overhead was very low. It was a key principle that the NHS workforce would be publicly employed, so you had quality control built in, and you were in charge of the training of the staff. So by maintaining that level of control, you avoided what we've seen subsequently, which is a dumbing down and a managing on the cheap, and, you know, various other quality control issues which have degraded the service.
Because there is a bit of a tug of war going on, with some saying the National Health Service is being privatised, others saying no, it's just some of the services are being farmed out. It's still very much a public body.
Well, it's publicly funded, but it's privately controlled and privately orientated. So now, I'll give you one example. If you look at Private Finance Initiative, which was the Blair-Brown mechanism for building new hospitals, what that effectively did was it masked a massive contraction in bed capacity. For every new hospital built using PFI, it usually had a third less beds than the one it replaced. So you're shrinking bed capacity. To finance hospital building using PFI was extremely expensive. So the public borrowed $11 billion from the private sector, and we will have to pay back $80+ billion. So that's more than a sevenfold increase in cost of the loan. And at the end of which, we don't own the hospital. So you've actually transferred ownership, reduced bed capacity, saddled it with toxic debt liability, and transferred ownership. That is privatization in anybody's book. And if you add on top of that the corporate bloated management administrative structure, which is now sucking away at least 20% of NHS costs, you know, the total budget. So you've got debt servicing, you've got the administrative management cost, which has ballooned, and you've got a whole plethora of contracts that have been outsourced. Not only you're outsourcing the contract, but you have to put it in a way that allows the private provider to cream off a profit. Now, whatever's creamed off in profit is not going into patient care. So it's a complete lie, and it has to be a lie that is maintained by the private sector, the private the privatization lobby, they have to keep lying until they can lie no more.
Well, anyone that's been reading Private Eye, even since the 1980s, and actually quite a bit of the mainstream press too, Bob, has noticed that many government-funded IT contracts run way over budget, and quite often, after millions and millions of good money being poured after bad, you end up with an IT system that doesn't work. One of the most recent ones was to do with the Secret Services and Special Branch and their terrorism database, which was rolled out across the country, but it didn't work. There were certain detectives like Tony Thorne in South Wales who protested against this and saying, well, we've spent millions on this now and it's not working. But the same, I just wonder if the same sort of thing is true with the NHS. I look at the there's an attempt, I think it's called Digital NHS or something, that quite a lot of money, rather than going on patient care, is going on these systems, which we've got a track record of failing.
Yeah, so there was a big example in the early 2010s. In the early 2000s, it was called Connecting for Health. It turned out to be one of the biggest contracting fiascos. It totally failed. It cost the taxpayer over £10 billion. And the guy who was cheerleading for it was a guy called Simon Stevens, who then went on to work in America for United Health, a big insurance company, only to return back to the NHS under the coalition government. But there's no accountability for what is a huge waste of taxpayers' money. But, you know, what people need to understand is none of this was actually designed to achieve a positive endpoint. These are just mechanisms for lining the pockets of big corporations and big IT companies. Because there's never any sanction. There's no risk to the commercial company of failure. They cash up in every incident, whereas the taxpayer is left to foot the bill.
Well, I mean, it could even be, the idea is to sort of bleed the NHS in order to, use the nudge unit to nudge people towards private healthcare. And I know you have put together a film. Can you just tell us about why you decided to do that and what it's called?
Yeah, so the film we put out back in 2019 is called The Great NHS Heist. The reason we felt we had to do it was purely because the lack of public awareness, thanks to no mainstream media coverage, or if there was coverage, it was totally misleading. And the aim of the film was to say, look, the NHS, think about it as a series of assets. You've got the land, you've got the infrastructure, you've got the budgets attached to patients, and you've got the digital, the data. Now, these three assets are extremely profitable, especially if you run it at the expense of providing patient care. And you have very big international corporate players who are eyeing the NHS up, including the private insurance industry from America, the big tech companies such as Palantir, and the hospital providers who are looking to cut service provision so they can keep what money is not spent on the patient as profit.
Has the film really had much of an effect? Where do you think we are now, 5 years after this?
The people who've seen the film, it's been a wake-up call for them. You know, I'm just a jobbing GP. I don't have a promotion or advertising budget. The idea was really to educate activists so they get the messaging right, because at the moment, a lot of the messaging coming from supposed activists is some sort of future threat of privatization, but it's largely been achieved. So it was an attempt to get the framing right for people who want to get actively involved in spreading the word.
So who is lobbying for this? Where's the lobby?
Lobby for the preservation.
I mean, it's something that's happening incrementally over decades. Who's lobbying for it?
Well, nobody is overtly lobbying for it, but there is a big propaganda operation which includes the mainstream news, the BBC, the ITV, Sky, they never get to the crux of the problem. They never talk about the burden of private finance initiative or the market bureaucracy. It's always about the poor NHS is struggling and it needs more money. Well, that plays into the hands of the privatization lobby. You have these think tanks such as the Adam Smith Institute and others that produce reports, even the supposedly neutral think tanks like Nuffield Trust, they produce reports which ignore the reality on the ground, which is a political project that has totally mutated the NHS structure and function. And the politicians, we have a cross-party consensus. Labour, Liberal, Democrat, Conservative, they've all sort of fused into a neoliberal political consensus, which is about reducing taxes for the super rich, turning all public services into a cash cow for private interests, and deregulation, which means removing public protections. They make it sound acceptable by cutting red tape, but what they mean is we want a Wild West where anybody can provide any service, and we will just create a smokescreen of supervision and scrutiny, but actually the quality continues to slide downwards. You just have to look at the privatized, you know, waterways and the utilities. We pay through the nose and we get worse and worse product.
At the coalface, one of the most obvious changes has been waiting lists. We went from maybe hundreds or days on to millions and years for many basic operations like hip operations or, you know, that sort of thing. So can you see any signs that this newish Labour government in 2024 might start bringing those waiting lists down again, Bob?
They might start to bring them down, but the solution is predetermined. The solution is to bring in yet more private sector. They've used the unnecessary pain and suffering and death of the public as a huge nudge factor to make private provision more acceptable. Instead of outsourcing, what they're considering doing is getting private providers to use the real estate of the NHS to work within hospitals to provide waiting list reduction surgery, which will be highly profitable. They will pick off the easiest operations that have a significant financial return for them, and they will present this as some success. But they allowed the problem to be generated in the first place. So it's the pattern. You have problem, reaction, solution. They manufacture the problem. They propose something that superficially seems like a good idea. And we have yet more privatization achieved on the back of it.
And related, very closely related, is this whole problem is social care. Do you see any solution to that on the horizon at all with this particular, particularly for the elderly, a lot of them finding it's impossible to discharge them from hospital because they're actually they're better, but there's just nowhere to put them because they may need a little bit of care, maybe once a day or once a week. It's becoming a service which seems to have lost all its funding, and it's causing bed blocking and all sorts of other problems.
Yeah, fundamentally across society, we have normalized what is in fact neglect. The social services and care home, is vast majority of it is privatized. The ownership has slipped into private equity groups that asset strip and saddle with debt nursing homes so that they collapse. And we've seen that happen with Southern Cross, I believe it was, the nursing home provider. So that they have already set the precedent, and people just shrug their shoulders, and we have to step in as taxpayers. So the crisis within social care, well, you know, when we reduced funding and we made everything means testing, well, this was a way of preventing working class wealth transfer between generations. So this was, in fact, a very subtle asset grab whereby elderly people paying for care ended up losing the value of their house in care payments. But before the privatization of social care started, the vast majority of this was publicly funded. There wasn't any profit extraction, and the staff were treated with a bit of dignity and respect, often employed by local councils with pensions and other benefits. But that's all gone. So we have a workforce which is employed on minimum wage, maybe gig economy workers, who are working for private equity companies who are just there to sweat the assets and extract as much profit as possible. And that means that the neglect of the patients they're supposed to look after.
On some more recent bits of news, we've got the assisted dying bill going through, and various people are saying it's a good idea, others suggesting maybe that it's the problems and lack of palliative care, the drop in the standards there, that might actually nudge people, might nudge individuals, families almost into saying, well, I'm too much of a burden on those around me, so maybe I should just slip off. It's almost like a kind of suicide note, really. And there is this, I mean, I've seen some of the campaigns on the other side saying, well, actually, what about this idea of assisted living? It's like society is not interested anymore in assisted living, so assisted dying is the solution. What's your thoughts?
Well, I think this is a deeply troubling step, but it fits in with what's been happening to public services and, you know, the economy for most working people in general. Over the last few decades, we've seen a downward pressure on wages. There's been a decoupling in terms of wages and productivity. We've seen a removal of welfare payments. We've seen the value of pensions shrinking. So in effect, there has been an economic assault on the vast majority of the public. Meanwhile, the super rich get even richer. And now we have a situation where people are languishing on waiting lists, getting very relatively poor service from the NHS, which is overstretched. This has been internalized by many people, and they now accept that suffering is part of what this country is all about. And when you normalize that, then people might see, well, you know, I don't want to be a burden, exactly as you describe, and maybe the only way out is to go for this assisted suicide. Effectively, that's what we're being pushed towards. But, you know, before the NHS was came into being in 1948, even before that, just when it was announced, there was a huge drop in suicides because people could see an end to their suffering. What we're actually doing is returning to that period where people can't see an end to their suffering. They have to pay for their care, and they see that as a financial burden. And even if they won't express that, they will consider themselves to be affecting the lives and the quality of lives of their families. And when you normalize that within society, you reduce the stigma attached to taking that action. But what we should be talking about is providing the best quality palliative care. And in 30 years, only once has a patient spoken to me about, could I help them exit this life? Only once. And after a, you know, short conversation with him about how palliative care works, and my experience with palliative care has been very positive. People are dealt with dignity. You can medicate for a lot of the pain and other symptoms when you're approaching the end. And he was reassured and fortunately had a very peaceful and respectful, dignified death. So the government and the media are pushing the idea of assisted suicide as if it was a big issue. But actually, it's not a big issue, but they're making it into a big issue so that they can complete their agenda, which is an anti-human agenda, I'm afraid, and it goes in line with everything else they've done, removing access to healthcare and impoverishing people.
Well, they're saying, Bob, that the safeguards are all there, you know, with doctors making having a special look at each individual that wants to do this, as well as it being done in a legally professional fashion. But, you know, I'm left in the back of my mind thinking, well, someone might just have a bad day, you know, and because obviously elderly people do. All sorts of people do have a bad day, and then but there's obviously, once you sign this piece of paper, there's no going back.
Yeah, so that's politics. How else could they push forward a potentially controversial new bill without providing a cover narrative that there are safeguards in place? Well, where were the safeguards when they decided to discharge 20,000 COVID infective people back into nursing homes? Where were the safeguards, you know, in international law, which would prohibit a genocide in Gaza? Where are these legal safeguards? So it's a very dangerous step, and the current crop of politicians cannot be trusted to act in the interest of the individual or the vast majority of the people in this country, because they are actively doing everything they can to do the opposite.
There's another issue I'd like to ask you about, which is antidepressant drugs. I've come across more and more stories to do with these types of medication. I imagine you yourself have seen an increase in the number, largely from economic reasons, of people coming to you with depressions, exhibiting depression. The obvious thing that some doctor might do is just simply prescribe antidepressant drugs, and then people can find themselves hooked on these drugs. If they try to come off them, they're getting withdrawal symptoms, and also the drug itself is not really making their condition any better. So do you think, is there anything you'd like to share with us about, you know, to sort of raise people's awareness and knowledge about how these drugs work and how effective they really are?
Yeah, so a lot of people who are coming with anxiety or depression, it's usually a reaction to their personal circumstances. A lot of those are economic. So we have a political class that are actually creating the environment to drive a lot of people into struggles with their mental health. There is an increasing perception that the only way to rectify this is to go on medication. But the SSRIs, you know, the studies that were done on these drugs, they're not that impressive and not very effective either, because if you give somebody an SSRI, 50% of them may feel better. That sounds good. Only when you compare it to placebo, and the placebo may make 40% of them feel better. So it's not that much better than placebo. People do tend to get at least psychologically dependent on these medications, which, if used long term, can lead to permanent sexual dysfunction, we know about. And also, if you stop them all of a sudden, you will get discontinuation symptoms. So, you know, the solution for a lot of the problems are really societal, rather than in a pill box.
Yeah, I wonder, do you think, I mean, certainly in the old days, if we can use that phrase, say the 1940s, 1950s, some of the issues which people are going to doctors about now, they might have in those days gone to their local priest or vicar.
Absolutely. Or, you know, places where people would meet, for example, community centres or pubs or working men's clubs, a lot of which have disappeared. Society is very much more fragmented. Those opportunities to have a chat and confide in other people and offload some of your worries are getting fewer and further between. So this sort of degrading of society and connection with your neighbours is contributing to social isolation. The pressures on families and the disintegration of the extended family and the social network all contributes to people feeling low and anxious.
Your film, maybe you could just tell listeners whereabouts they can find it, and maybe you'd like to recommend, you know, some health campaigns and possibly your own social networks.
Yes, the most of the time I'm on social media is on my Twitter. My Twitter handle is Dr. Bob Gill. The film's called The Great NHS Heist, and it's there on YouTube if you just search for the title. In terms of groups that have done good work, there's a group called Every Doctor, which has some good messaging and tries to do a lot of awareness raising. Merseyside Pensioners Association actually do quite a lot of good work in general, but also on the NHS. There are other groups out there in the sort of NHS health activism space, but unfortunately some of them are conflicted. They are very sort of pro-labor and maybe getting health union money, but these health unions have been extremely quiet on what's happening to the health service. So that might explain why they haven't been as effective as you would have hoped.
Okay, Dr. Bob Gill, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.